Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Welcome, everyone. I actually was under the impression that this was going to be a small, intimate lunch of like 25 people, so I was quite shocked to see you all here, but I shouldn't be shocked because everyone's a Lee Child fan. Everyone has a Lee Child fan in their family. They were saying before that people get you mixed up with your character, Jack Reacher, and I'm not surprised that that's happened because 7 hours after arriving in Sydney, you got on a Greyhound bus and it went into the city and crashed into a tree, causing an enormous spectacle and perhaps starting a huge adventure. Can you tell us about that?
First of all, let me say thank you very much to everybody for coming. We had a little reception party last night for the Penguin Random House staff and the booksellers and some super fans and so on. And for the sake of it, because we had transportation, we had to get from A to B, we thought we'd do it in a Greyhound bus. And yes, it did unfortunately crash into a tree. And the rearview mirror fell off. The driver was very embarrassed, but we were fine with it. You know, it was not a problem. The door opened and we were able to get out and have the party, so no sweat. We did not all end up in the hospital, which would have been a drag.
It would have, yes. So you're only in the country for 96 hours. I wondered if you have managed to sneak in any very Sydney-ish sorts of things. Have you gone to Coogee and fed chips to the seagulls or ridden the ferry or something like that?
Well, this is my fourth visit overall. Mm. I was here in 2000, 2005, 2010, but it has been 8 years since I was last here. And happily, wonderfully, in those 8 years, the Reacher thing has built up and up and up. So that when I first came, my poor publicist was like desperate to get anybody to pay any attention to me whatsoever, which left a lot of time for sightseeing. And I did all that stuff the first time and the second time. And this time, I think I've had possibly 45 seconds between engagements, just long enough for a couple of drags on my cigarette and then on to the next thing. Mm. And that's really what you want. You know, it's an absolute dream come true that people are reading my books and caring about them and talking about them. And so no author could possibly complain about being too busy. It's the opposite that is the problem.
Yeah. How do your Australian fans compare to fans across the world? I mean, you must be noticing them saying Reacher rather than Reacher.
Yeah, they speak funny, that's for sure. But not quite as funny as they speak in New Zealand, which is that's even worse. But there's a lot of identification with Reacher here, I think, because, you know, this is a self-reliant, rugged country where people see themselves, you know, they're not whingers, they get on with it in the same way that Reacher does. So I think there is a lot of natural sympathy for him and a lot of natural connection. So I guess that's why I do okay here. Why I do okay in America, I don't know, because they are a bunch of whingers over there.
Ooh, so glad to see you here. It's your 23rd Jack Reacher novel. I don't suppose you ever get nervous about the release of a book anymore?
Yeah, I really do.
You do?
Yeah, totally I do. It's partly because it's a drug. You know, once you make it to number one, and you make it to number one, you sort of, first of all, you want to be truly number one. And because the way that book charts are, generally speaking, tabulated, they do it by category. Hardcover fiction, hardcover nonfiction, paperback fiction, paperback nonfiction, how-to, children's, this, that, the other. And so you can be number one in your category, but are you really the overall number one? Mm. And if you really want to be the overall number one, and then you want to be the overall number one every time, and if you're number one for 1 week, then next time you want to be number one for 2 weeks, and then you want to be number one for 3 weeks. It's a never-ending treadmill of self-torture, really. And so I am nervous about it every time. Plus, the way I write is completely disorganized. I have no plan, no outline, no formula, no roadmap. So everything feels like a high-wire act. And I'm always wondering, well, I'm not wondering, I'm always convinced. Yeah, I've done it 22 times, but the 23rd time is a disaster. Finally, I've been found out. I'm a fraud. I can't do it anymore. Mm. But somehow magically it always comes out all right. And this book in particular I was a little nervous about, simply because I felt last year's book was really good.
Yeah.
I thought last year's book had a lot of emotional heft to it. Mm. And I was worried that this book didn't, but everybody seems to like this book. In fact, I just read a review this morning that said, I got an email from a guy that said, I think this is your best ever. And, you know, I'm thinking, really? All right, I'll take that.
I loved it. I tend to get quite shouty about a book if I'm enjoying it, and I shouted at my husband the whole time that I was reading this book, and he'd read it before me, and this is a book which it leads you towards, you can see something terrible is going to happen. There are these two people at a motel, not Reacher, but they meet up with Reacher in the end, and something very mysterious and awful is going to happen. You can see it coming, and my husband knew what it was, and so the whole time I was reading it going, what's going to happen? You know, but I wondered with your methodology of how you write, were you leading yourself all the way up to this terrible conclusion, not knowing what it was going to be?
Yeah, that's why it took so long to get there.
Yeah.
Because I had to decide what it was, and I thought, what is it? And I couldn't decide, so I thought, all right, we'll put it off a little bit, so... I just kept on going. But the way it started out, because, like I say, I have no plan whatsoever, no outline. I just write the beginning, the first line or the first paragraph. And in the first paragraph, it mentions a couple of things. First of all, it says the Reacher spent the end of the summer in the state of Maine. Mm-hmm. And then it says, because he likes to be warm in the winter, he began his migration south like the birds in the sky above him. And so I finished that section, and I thought, all right, what does this mean? Or how can I then do a second paragraph? And I thought, why did I put Maine? And I thought, well, Stephen King lives in Maine. Mm. Maybe that's why I put it. Maybe I can do a strand in this story that's a bit like Stephen King, something really creepy feeling. So that was one idea. And then the other thing, why did I put birds in the opening paragraph? And years ago, I did a book where a very brief mention of Reacher's father. He was a Marine infantry officer, a real stone killer. And in order to humanize him, I said he was a bird watcher. So I thought, wait a minute. So there's a subliminal unconscious connection here to Reacher's dad. Maybe this is the book about his dad. Mm. Because years ago, I did a book about his mom. So I thought, yeah, this is a book about his dad. But I was nervous about that because in real life, my dad had just died. And I thought everybody's going to think this is some kind of sentimental thing because my dad had just died. And it really wasn't. It was just because I'd mentioned bird watching.
It's interesting because you wrote about Reacher's mother in The Enemy, and she turned out to be not what he thought she was. And in this novel, I won't give it away, but you find out things about Reacher's father. He's not what Reacher thought he was. And so are you trying to say something about parents or family?
Yeah, I mean, the original thing in The Enemy where, you know, Reacher is a famously tough guy, and I thought we need to explore the roots of that. And I did not want to do that cliche where Reacher's a tough guy because his dad beat him or his dad was a tough guy or something. I felt that was a cliche. So I thought, let's make him a tough guy because his mom was a tough guy. Hmm. And she had done this incredibly heroic thing at a very young age and never revealed it to anybody. And they did not find out about it until after she died. She died in The Enemy. And Reacher and his brother, who were still alive at that time, they found a cigar box with some old mementos of hers, and there was a medal in there. And why had she won this medal? Mm. And so, you know, that's why the mom was the inspiration behind Reacher. I just thought we should say thank you to mothers everywhere because they're the ones that actually bring the kids up. Let's face it.
We've only got a little bit of time to talk to each other today. It's 25 minutes, which is a very long time if you're the interviewer and you're a bit nervous as I am, but it's not very long. So I feel like now we need to dedicate a little bit of this time to the Tom Cruise thing, because if we don't mention it, everybody will just lose their minds and they'll all mob you out there to ask you about it. So you have some news about people portraying Reacher on the screen.
Yeah, you know, the Tom Cruise issue has dogged me now for 7.5 years since it was announced. It was announced in March of 2011, and I remember nobody was really very keen on the idea, and I remember going to the Harrogate Festival in July that year. You've been there.
Yeah, I was there.
And a good friend of mine, an agent, not my agent, but an agent, and she walks up to me and said, "You sold out." And I thought, "What, you too?" But what she'd meant was all the tickets for my event were gone. Which was not because I was just in the habit of assuming everybody was very negative about it.
Yeah.
And what you've got to understand for me is that from a writer's perspective, I never gave it any thought. I didn't care who played Reacher in the movie. I really didn't, because I didn't care about the movie particularly. It was, for me, the book is the product.
Yeah.
The book is the ultimate product. There is nothing beyond the book. And it's sort of puzzling to a book writer when people imagine that a book is not yet the final product. All of you people, you're in the Dimmocks book club. You understand books. You like books. But most regular people don't feel the same way. And if a writer is on a plane, for instance, and you are foolish enough to talk to the person sitting next to you, inevitably they're going to say, "What do you do?" And now what I say is, "I'm a drug dealer." Because... that then kills the conversation dead, and I don't have to go through all the business. But if you say, "I'm a writer," then inevitably, 100% of the time, their next question is, "Oh, have any of your books been made into movies?"
Yes. Yeah.
As if a book is not enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
As if a book is just a pupa or a chrysalis, just yearning to become a movie, whereupon it is now valid and grown up and real. And no book writer feels like that. The book is the ultimate product. Everything else is a side issue.
Yeah.
So I was very unconcerned, which was very stupid and short-sighted of me, because the readers got terribly upset because Tom Cruise was not an exact physical facsimile of Jack Reacher. And I have to say, he's a lovely guy. We became good friends. He works incredibly hard. He is a charming, charming gentleman. None of what you hear in the media about Cruise is true. He never once mentioned anything to do with Scientology. There was no nonsense whatsoever. He was just a thoroughly, thoroughly nice guy, really talented actor, a fine human being, a very hard worker, but sadly, vertically challenged. And people felt very let down by it. And my prime loyalty is always to the reader. I love my readers. I'm deeply, deeply grateful to my readers. And if the readers are upset about something, then I'm going to take their side. So much as I love Cruise as an actor and a person, I had to do something about this issue because everybody was getting so upset. So in the movie contract is a lovely clause that says, once we've done two movies, I have a veto over whether we do any more. And what I've decided to do is, no, we are not going to do any more movies. We're not going to do any more with Tom Cruise. Instead, we are going to take it to binge-watching television with a completely new actor.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And so everybody applauding now has a distinct responsibility. It is up to you to... You've got to nominate people. You've got to give me your opinions. Maybe we could have a poll. You can choose. You can maybe have a short list or something like that. In other words, if it doesn't work again this time, it is going to be your fault, not mine. He's going to be the biggest, scariest dude you have ever seen. I hope it's an unknown person, which it might be, because television is not star-driven in the same way that feature films are. And so we could probably get a complete unknown, probably have to be an unknown, because actors are usually small. And I'm really, really interested in as to why. You know, cinema is more than 100 years old. And actors in general have evolved towards being very small people. And there's got to be a reason for that, some optical reason, some film plane reason. We don't know what it is exactly, but they're mostly small. And most actors are very handsome. And Reacher is not very handsome.
Yeah.
So we need to find a huge guy who is also ugly. Which means he probably does not have a thriving acting career right now. So with a bit of luck, he will be unknown.
Not ugly necessarily, but I think of Reacher as being thuggish, you know, having a heavy brow and...
Well, I see him as like a lock forward in a rugby team. In fact, my mental image of him when I first wrote about him all those years ago was an English rugby player called Lawrence Dallaglio. Look him up on the internet from, you know, from his playing days. And he is a big, scary dude, and I would never say this to his face, but he's not really very good looking either. So I think he would be the perfect, that sort of physical type would be absolutely perfect.
Right, right. And it'll be an interesting challenge because you'll have Reacher, but I imagine, you know, every series or depending on how you do it, perhaps every episode, you'll have to have a whole new cast because it's really just Reacher who carries himself on from book to book. You've got Garber, for example, who's an ongoing character, but you'll have to sack the whole cast and get a whole new one.
Yeah, well, every season. I mean, I think the plan is to do one book per sort of 10 to 12 hour season. And then, yeah, you know, there are very few repeating characters in the Reacher series. Mm. Because I just felt when I was starting out the series, I wanted to do something that was distinctive and not the same as everybody else. And generally speaking, crime or thriller series are fundamentally soap operas. And I say that with no denigration whatsoever, because I used to work in television, and soap operas put food on my table for 20 years. And soap operas are actually very difficult and sophisticated narrative devices. And soap opera audiences actually are very sophisticated audiences. Mm. They can carry story strands in their head that may not recur for months. Mm. So there's nothing wrong with soap operas, except everybody was doing them. So I wanted just one guy with no job and no home, so they're not location-based or employment-based. Mm-hmm. And in a way, that robs you of an awful lot. The recurring characters are often attractive. The relationship between characters are often interesting. So to get rid of the soap opera robs you of a lot of stuff, but it actually then also gives you a lot of opportunities for flexibility, for freshness, always moving on. But it does mean that there are very few recurring characters. So you're right. Each season, we're going to have a wholesale change of cast, which is fine. You know, that would be good fun.
There's going to have to be other promises that you're making, not only for a big Reacher, but also, you know, a leading lady. Every time I read a Lee Child book and the first woman that Reacher encounters, I think, oh, will it be her? Was she the one for this book? I always hope there's going to be a romance. You know, and the fights. I like the fight to slow right down, and I want to see every little bit. I think if you don't have the TV series covering that kind of thing, you're going to have people angry at you. There's a whole new spate of opportunities for people to be angry at you coming out of this.
Yeah, although, you know, one of the sort of inside things about this switch will be actually making movies, making feature films is really a bit of a miserable thing at the moment, because every single minute of every single day is dominated by worrying about what rating it is going to get. Mm. You know, in America, they have what they call PG, which means parental guidance, that if your parents say it's okay to go to see it, you can. And, of course, no kid ever really asks their parent. So PG means general audience. And then above that is R, which is restricted. Mm. And the R audience is about one-eighth the size of the general audience. And so every movie maker wants it to be a PG, which means they worry constantly, literally every frame, is this going to get past the censor? Hmm. You know, Reacher hits somebody, is there a drop of blood? It's perfectly all right to hit somebody in the face. If there's a drop of blood, it's not.
And I'm thinking about In the Enemy, where he kicks the guy's leg and it snaps up and his shoe hits his own hip or something. How are you going to do that?
Yeah, you see, that would be an R-rated move.
Yeah, yeah. Like Quentin Tarantino-type violence.
And so they would never do it, but... Yeah. cable TV and streaming TV has none of that. And so, and I'm not saying we're going to turn the Reacher thing into a kind of obscene barbarity, but it just means that we don't have to worry every minute of every day. You do what you need to do.
Yeah.
So that is going to be pretty relaxing, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So rounding it out, getting back to past tense, which is what we want everyone to pick up, because it's an absolute fantastic novel. So can you write while you travel? Did you write before coming here this morning?
No, I can't write while I travel because I have this thing that if I have to stop, if I know that I got to stop at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock or whatever, then the whole day is laid to waste. It's some kind of subconscious thing. I think, oh, well, there's really no point starting that scene because I can't, you know, I won't have time to develop it. Yeah. I won't have time to finish it. So if I have anything else to do that day, I don't write.
Yeah.
And so I don't write on the road, partly because, like I said, I only have a 45-second gap between things. And
yes,
the way I labor over the words, and 45 seconds I might be able to do one word. So I'm on the road 3 weeks, so the book would advance by 21 words.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really not worth it.
I remembered what I wanted to say about past tense, is that there is a very exclusive short story about Australia in the back of it, and I've read it, and it's fantastic. And Reacher spends even less time in Australia than you do, but he gets stuff done.
He does, yeah. I mean, what we love to do now is, you know, retailers like Dimmocks and people are other chains around the world, they're so important to us because book selling right now is not easy. You know, the book trade is under a lot of pressure from a lot of different competing attractions. It's not easy. I mean, I have to say it's never been easy. But it's particularly difficult at the moment. And so if it's possible to add value in some way, we always will. So for Australia, they're claiming also it's for New Zealand, but it really isn't. It was for Australia only. They said, what? Could you possibly write a short story where Reacher comes to Australia? And I thought, yeah, why not? So there's a short story in the back of the book as a bonus content, is what we call it. And Reacher comes to Sydney, and he spends about, I haven't really worked it out, like 5 hours
here?
It's
5 hours, yeah.
He spends 5 hours here, during which he kills several people and breaks several bones. And then he gets back on the plane.
Yeah, straight back on the plane. Yeah. No, I loved it. I thought it was really good. It was to the point. I think you could write a short story with Reacher in New Zealand. You know, there's a sheep rustler or something. Reacher has to find them. And I think you're going to enjoy your time over there. If you have a question, could you please raise your hand nice and high? We have a mic coming around. And here we go. Question
Thank
number
you.
One.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Could you tell us how and where Jack Reacher was born, emerged, inspired?
Well, I mean, I sort of can in retrospect, but I was very, very keen not to inquire too closely at the time because, as I said, I'd worked in television and before that in the theatre. Really, basically, I've always worked in the world of entertainment. And the one thing you learn really, really quickly is that you cannot design or manufacture or force a success. You just absolutely can't. All success is kind of accidental. Or to put it another way, the success of a character is not up to the author. The author does not decide this is a cool character. The audience decides that they're cool. And there's nothing the author can do about that. You just present an honest character, and it's up to the reader to decide whether he's cool or not. And the more that the author tries, the harder you try to make him cool, the worse and more embarrassing it gets. So really all you can do is do what you want to do and hope for the best. And therefore I did not want to inquire too deeply about it. I didn't want to write out a laundry list. You know, he's got to be this, he's got to be that. And fiction is bought by a lot of women, so he must satisfy that, and you know, the age demographic, but also you want young men, so we better do this. As soon as you start doing that, you are totally lost. All you can do is write what you want to write, cross your fingers and hope for the best. So it was many, many years before I felt confident about trying to understand where he came from. And clearly, naturally. He must come from things that I've read or consumed before. And he is an ancient, ancient figure, the knight errant, the mysterious stranger, the noble loner who shows up in the nick of time, solves the problem, and then rides off into the sunset. And that character has been around for thousands of years in every culture. The Japanese culture has exactly this figure, the Ronin, a samurai who has been disowned by his master, sentenced to wander the land. Medieval Europe had exactly that character. And so that's where he comes from. He is the modern version of Robin Hood or Shane or Sir Lancelot or Sir Gawain or even Odysseus. People love that character because we crave it. You know, if you are in desperate trouble, you would love it if somebody would just show up, fix the problem, and especially leave afterward. Because otherwise you've got all these gratitude issues. What do you do with the guy afterward? He has to move on. And that's why the myth was created that way. The only time in mythology that the guy has not left was the Pied Piper of Hamelin. He stuck around because he hadn't been paid and he murdered all the children.
And I think there are lots of situations where everyone could use a reacher to do the things that they think about doing. Like, I would love to hurl my bar stool at this guy's face, but I need someone else to come in and do it so there aren't the consequences.
Yeah, which I think is why the readers love him so much, because look at this crowd. Lovely, civilized people. I mean, you are the book readers, by definition, are the most thoughtful, intelligent, informed people in society. Looking at you, you are the most lovely, civilized types, and so you will never admit it. But I know for a fact that the appeal of Reacher for you is that you have, each of you has a list of 10 people you would cheerfully shoot in the head.
Yeah, it's true. At least 10. Oh, we have another question over here.
Hi, I was wondering what a normal writing day looks like for you.
A normal writing day for me is I get up disgracefully late and I have what I call the traditional English breakfast, which is 7 camels and 6 cups of coffee. And then I start work at about 1 o'clock because I have very, very few rules in my life, but one strict rule is that nothing of value is ever achieved in the morning. So I start work late in the day, and I usually finish, if the baseball season is still on, which runs up until about the end of October, I will finish around 7 o'clock in order to watch the game. And then as I get deeper into the book, I might work till 8 o'clock. And then when I'm really deep in the book, I might go back to it at midnight and do a few more hours. So I'm a late worker. And I just sit there and try and do 1,500 words a day as a minimum. Usually I'm lazy about it, and so after Christmas I'm in a panic, so I'm doing 2,000 words a day. But I just sit there until it's done.
Hello. With past tense, I just wondered, because there's two very separate stories, did you write them together, or did you sort of write one and then the other and join them together?
That's a good question, and I don't think I could have done them separately. They were written absolutely in sequence, partly because I never, ever change anything that I've written. I write it. I have another of my rules is do it once and do it right. And so I start at the beginning, I write the book, which is why I'm relatively slow, because I'm constantly puzzling out what's going to happen. But overall, I'm a quick writer because I never revise afterward. And so I write the book, and that is what has happened. That's the story. And I assure you, I'm a completely sane and rational person. But when I'm doing it, that is happening. This is truth. And afterward, the editor will often say to me, wouldn't it be better if this happened before that? And I say, yeah, probably, but it didn't.
Hello, and thanks for being here. I'm an avid Reacher follower. I'm not going to mention the dreaded person, that one, but my question goes to the process. Now, over the years, I've come to these events and listened to authors whose stories have gone on to be optioned for films. Some of them have said they want they've written the book, and that's the end of it. They sell it, take the check, end. Others have said, yes, we've actually gone in and continued writing the script for the film or the TV series. A third group have said that their book has been sort of taken apart and they've sold or optioned main characters, and that's been it. Now, I deduce, possibly wrongly, from what you've said about your TV series, that you're still taking an interest, at least in Reacher. How is your process going to go? Are you going to be the scriptwriter for the series as well?
No, I'm not going to write the scripts for the series, because I think that adapting your own stuff is incredibly difficult. And I know that because I've done it to other people's stuff. I've been hired as a screenwriter for... While I've been a novelist, I've had a sort of shadow secret career, actually, where the Tom Cruise deal was done in 2005, and at the time there was a lot of competition for it. And one of the producers who wanted it and who lost out was somehow impelled. He wanted me to be involved in something that he was doing. And so he had me write a screenplay based on a pitch concept that he had, you know, what they call a capsule thing. It was just the elevator pitch, 10 seconds of talk. And somebody had written a screenplay based on that, but it was absolutely awful. I wondered, had this guy ever seen a movie? It was really bad. And so the producer wanted me to rewrite that. So I did. I rewrote it and had a lot of fun doing it, and I got paid. Actually, I'll tell you who it was in a minute, but I didn't really want to work with the guy that badly. It was quite intriguing. And the best way with Hollywood, if you don't want to work with somebody, is you just ask for too much money. And then the whole thing fizzles out, and everybody's face is saved, and nobody's upset. But this guy actually paid it. And in fact, so much that I bought a painting by Renoir with that fee. And so I wrote the screenplay. Of course, it never went anywhere, because almost all screenplays never go anywhere. But I was very aware that you've really got to be brutal. You've got to be brutal. You've got to be callous. You've got to tear this thing apart and then put it back together in a way that works. And you cannot do that with your own stuff. You just absolutely can't, because you're too close to the material. You've got too much emotional investment. You've got... How could I chop anything out of my own books? Obviously, every word is genius. Otherwise, why would have I put it in? You know? It's very tough with your own stuff. And so I did not want to do... I don't want to touch my own stuff. It's much better if a third party does it, because they can be brutal and they can be callous, because they don't have the investment in it emotionally. So I want to stay out of that process completely. I want a strategic overview, strategic control. I retained approval over various things like the casting, the screenwriter, and so on. I want the approval, or at least be able to advise. And I retained control over the soundtrack, because I think that's very important these days in a way that actually Hollywood underestimates. And so I'll have a strategic view, but I certainly don't want to be involved in the day-to-day stuff. And that movie producer, he really liked the screenplay that I did. It was not bad at all. And then he kept on giving me other projects. It was really funny. One night, literally at midnight, I got a phone call from him saying they were up in Toronto shooting a movie, and it was by a very famous screenwriter based on a very famous book, and I'm contractually unable to say who they were because it would embarrass them, because it was not working. The final scene just did not work. And this guy said, if I email you the screenplay, will you rewrite the final scene overnight and have it back to us by 6 a.m.? And like I said, I love working at night, and I love fixing problems. So I said, sure, I'll do that. And I did it, and it worked, and I'd done that repeatedly for the guy. I became a sort of secret story doctor, working the occasional night for the thing. And then it got to that he would want title suggestions. There was one particular movie which had a lousy working title. He couldn't think of a good title. So he wanted to send me the sort of pre-release DVD rough cut. Would I watch it? Would I suggest a title? And I was hanging out with my daughter at the time, actually, so we couriered over this DVD. We watched about 45 minutes of it, came up with two alternative titles, and sent them back. And it was actually my daughter's title that they used. But I took the money. And and that worked really, really well until suddenly last year it came grinding to a halt, and I have not done it since because the producer was Harvey Weinstein.
Oh, right. Ooh. I'm not sure. We don't have... Do we have time for one more? Okay. I was just going to quickly sneak one in if I can. I know I've had my time, but when the TV series comes up, will you please do a cameo in it yourself? Because your cameo is in the Mission Impossible...
Yeah, I'll
Tom
do
it. Cruise.
I'll definitely,
that was so good.
I'll definitely do a cameo, and because I love doing that. And I also love the art of it from an author's point of view, because every single author whoever has anything to do with a movie, they all want a cameo. Yeah. And the production team always says, of course, of course. And they shoot the cameo, and then they immediately edit it out, and it's gone. So what I do is I look at the screenplay first, and I pick a scene that they cannot edit out. Like in the first one, there was important dialogue happening in front of me. The movie would have made no sense without that dialogue, so they couldn't cut it out. And the second one, same thing. There was important action. Reacher was getting through an airport on a phony ID, and they couldn't cut that out, otherwise it would make no sense. So I choose my scenes very, very carefully, so I will always be in the movie.
Nice. There's a question over there, I believe.
Hi, I was wondering if you had an end to Jack Reacher at all, if you had planned it in your head, or like book number 30 or 25 or 50 or 100?
Well, this is book number 23, and I originally intended to end the series at 21, because as a tribute to a guy called John D. MacDonald, who wrote the Travis McGee series, which I think is one of the great series of all time, probably my favorite, the most technically accomplished series, I think. And he stopped at 21 simply because he died. And so I felt that as a homage to him, it would be respectful to match him at 21 and then stop. But I decided not to because people... And what I always thought, the final book, whenever it comes, the final book would be called Die Lonely. And it would be a difficult book to plot because Reacher is a pretty smart guy, but I would have to figure out a situation where... Reacher had a choice, either to give up himself or give up the person he was protecting. And obviously he would protect the person he was protecting. He would give up himself. So the final scene would be Reacher crawls into a filthy motel bathroom and bleeds out on the floor.
Oh,
that would be the end of Dial.
Wow.
And I started saying that partly to hear how loud the groan was.
Yeah.
So that I could judge whether it's worth continuing or not. But I've subsequently decided that actually that would be too cruel because happily over the years, people have, they really like the guy.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to give him a more kind of slightly ambiguous end. What he'll do is whatever the last book is, he will be on his way to the bus depot. And then he'll stop and he'll say, you know what, maybe I'll stay here. And he walks back to town, adopts a dog and lives happily ever after.
<A dog. laughs> Lovely.
Lee, I have a question for you. I was very disappointed that
Sorry, you went there.
You went with this book with the father. I have been waiting to find out what happened to Reacher's brother. You've given hints in a couple of books, and I want to know what happened to him. He did leave Reacher money, thank God, because that's obviously what he's living on. But there was this mysterious circumstance about how he died, and I thought, Reacher's going to find out about this one day. So I've been waiting. What's happening?
People are so hard on you. Yeah, I want this and I want that.
Well, I mean, I feel really, really bad about Reacher's brother because...
I like him. He's so
I like
sweet.
Him too, you know, and it was a very intimate thing for me because he's kind of based on my elder brother who you know, Joe Reacher looks a bit like Jack Reacher and my elder brother looks nothing like me, but the relationship was kind of similar. He's more intelligent than I am. but he was a real dweeb and a jerk and a sort of he was just a geek, and my parents were like super respectable conventional parents, and it killed them to do it. But when I started at primary school, they said to me, I had to, at every playtime, I had to go and make sure Richard was all right. And so I would have to defend Richard, because I was huge and a good fighter, and Richard was a skinny little kid. And so at every playtime for me at primary school, I would run out into the yard. First of all, I'd have to find who was tormenting Richard, you know, pulling his ears or beating him up or whatever. And I would have to smack them around, and then I'd go and play ball with my friends twice a day. And I liked Richard's brother. I liked him a lot. But it was absolutely necessary for Richard to be on his own. You know, the myth of the mysterious stranger, the noble loner, doesn't work if he's got a family. You know, you've got to be alone. So it was necessary to sacrifice the brother very early. But I do miss him, yeah. And no doubt we will figure out at some point, as long as I continue. But I am also sort of equally obsessed with you know, like sports or anything. You do not want to be the embarrassing guy that sticks around a season too long. I don't want to be remembered for a lousy final book. I'd rather be remembered for good books. So I'm trying to pick the moment to get out. And I feel pretty good about it at the moment, but who knows, maybe, because I'm very old now. That's the other thing. I famously started late in life, and, you know, I just did an interview with Reader's Digest where that was one of the questions. It's inspiring. I lost my job at 40, and I reinvented myself. So think about it. I was 40 when I started writing, and that's now 24 years ago. I just turned 64. And I come from Britain, and the whole point of working when you're in Britain is that you can retire at some point. And so I'm trying to pick the spot. I don't want to be the boring guy who sticks around too long. And so who knows whether we'll ever get to Richard's brother. So here's the thing. Fiction is up for grabs. It didn't actually happen. It's in somebody's imagination. It could be in your imagination. You write the book about Richard's brother. That'd be fine.
I think we have time for one final question, lady over here.
Thank you. Hi, good afternoon. My debut novel is due for release in February. Can you please share with us your thoughts and experiences from your first book launch and release?
Well, congratulations, and I hope it goes really, really well. Welcome to the dark side.
Welcome to the club.
It's a wonderful life, it really is, but yeah, my recollection of... first of all, you're going to hear a lot of people say it's really tough. And it is really tough. Releasing a first novel in 2019 is going to be tough. But then I remember releasing my first novel in 1997. All the established writers were saying to me, God, I'm glad I started when I started because it's really tough now. Mm-hmm. And then you talk to even older writers and they say, oh, I'm glad I started when I started because it's really tough then. And publishing is a bit like farming. There has never been a good year. They're always moaning about something. And so it will be very hard because, you know, when I published mine in 97, it was a tiny little thing, you know. In America, the first print was 18,000 copies, which is not many. Now I get 18,000 copies shoplifted in Manhattan alone. So that... Back then, it's small, and here's the thing. Here's the best piece of advice that I can give you. It is not about your first book. It is not about your second book. It's not really about your third book. It's just showing up year after year after year. If you show up year after year after year doing good work, you will succeed in the end. So do not get disheartened if the first book doesn't make much of a splash, because keep showing up and something will happen.
Oh. And on that very optimistic final note, please join me once again in thanking Lee Child for being here.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.